thank you so much for the lovely introduction, Ted, and thank you to Max for inviting me here today. I feel this is a very special talk because this is my hometown, because I grew up in Lindsay from the age of 4 until I left for college, for university. I was, myself, of course, grew up in Lindsay. My parents have lived in Lindsay straight through until now. We're in the same house that we first moved into. We're still on Melbourne Street. And so this is a presentation that I've given in many places, in many countries, because it's felt necessary. This is my first time I get to do it here in Lindsay. So I'm really grateful to Probus for providing the opportunity to share a story, which is in fact you could think of it as a mystery that needs to be solved. And it can only really be told if you have 40, 45 minutes. So usually, you know, when you speak, people give you 10 minutes. And it really can't be told in that length of time. So I'm just feeling really happy today. And so it has to do, as you can see from the image I've got here, it has to do with the way the world is and what it is that we can see clearly and what it is that's really hard to see. So I know that right now it feels like the world is in a catastrophic state in some ways. And in fact, it didn't start last week or last month. It started a long time ago. Certainly, we can go back to 2022 when Putin and Xi Jinping came out with what they called the No Limits Partnership. And so that meant that it was a declaration that there would be no limits on how they could cooperate, what they would do in this world. 2.5 weeks later, we saw Russia invade Ukraine. So that was cataclysmic. We're still staring at this this catastrophe. Or even if we go back to the election that brought in 2016, a government that I think made every man, woman, and child around the world suddenly feel like, wow, I'm qualified to be the president of the United States too. It seemed everyone was suddenly qualified. So maybe that was the beginning of the change that we're now seeing. It's very definitive. I think we can all see that it's a very different world that we live in. So for all the different reasons, I feel so blessed to have had the opportunities that I've had, the chances to be in a very different part of the world, to do the work that I've had a chance to do. And I'm so delighted that Lindsay as a community has played a role in enabling the non-governmental work that we have done there. But I'm going to talk today about this mystery. And here's what it is that I want to talk about. Let's see if I can use this pointer. No, I'm doing it backwards. Here we are. Okay, so this is Asia from a different perspective than we usually see, right? So this is the whole idea, is how can we start to see things from a different angle? And in particular, I'm going to talk about Tibet, which I'm very partisan about because I am Tibetan. My parents left Tibet in 1959. As Ted said, my father at the time was a monk, and he was in fact a monk at a very elite institution. Only the handful of people from that institution were picked to be his bodyguard escorts when they left Tibet. Our mother was 13. She was a shepherd. So they met in India in one of the refugee communities. So I am partisan here, is what I'm saying. But what I want to explain, and what I have tried for many years now to explain in different rooms, is regardless of what my personal opinion might be, just objectively speaking, we are seeing Tibet, and therefore we are seeing what I'm trying to get at is China. We are seeing the Chinese state in terms that are not altogether correct. And the more that we can see clearly the kind of the operating system of China, how it really works, then you can see more potential for how we can make the world more secure. So let's see. Okay, so here's the daytime view. And I want to try the pointer now. Bill, this is so great. Thank you for for the system that works here. Okay. Is what I'm trying to point to is this region, this bioregion, which is a ginormous plateau. It is the size of Western Europe. So if you put France and Germany and the UK and Spain and all the major countries together, Switzerland, it's slightly bigger than that, right? And so that is called the Tibetan Plateau. As you can see, it's circled by mountains. The most famous mountains, of course, are these, the youngest mountains in the world, which are the Himalayas. And a lot of people think that the Himalayas, that is Tibet. But that is just one border of Tibet. In fact, it's ringed by mountainous systems and the Gobi Desert. So it is just this landmass that sits on its own, has been for millennia, kind of the center of Asia, right? Where everything kind of circled around it. As you can see, here's India down here, and coming out this way, and where you see this all this green, that's the traditional Chinese homeland. So they're lowlander people. And this has always been, especially until the middle of the 20th century, very inaccessible. And especially, it's not that you couldn't go there. Yeah, you know, if you're really determined, you can go there. But it's hard to live there, and it's hard to colonize there, and it's hard to overrun such a place, right? And in fact, in the 1840s, there was an overrunning. The Tibet was invaded. You'll never guess. I won't even. It's just such a bizarre thing. Tibet was invaded by the Punjabis in 1840. Right? So it's forgotten, such a marginal event in history. But anyways, they were better equipped. They did take over. They did overwhelm the Tibetan military, which was not, you know, up to snuff. But then 6 months later, they all froze to death. So everybody left there and froze to death. And India never wanted ever again. Nehru said this in the 1950s. He said they were not interested in taking on China over Tibet because, he said, we tried it and it didn't work out well. Okay, so I want to talk a little bit about how such a place, right? It's 2.5 million square kilometers, right? It's almost a million square miles that can disappear. Now, it's not just disappeared off the political map, because it did disappear off the political map in 1959 when the Dalai Lama left Tibet for India, and then it was just considered definitive. It was considered that Tibet is a part of China, and it's unfortunate, but this is the way that it is. This gives you a picture of the extent of it, right? But how does such a region that is so massive kind of disappear, not just from the political map, but from the map in our minds, right, in global consciousness? Because that's what's happened. Over the past 30, 40 years, people have forgotten the relationship of Tibet to China is really defined by the space itself, by the land, by the territory, and the people who inhabit that space, and what is happening in their minds, who they think they are, right? And we have lost sight of this. I start with these satellite maps and these topographical maps because you can see stripped away of the political and administrative boundaries what it looks like. So, of course, as you can see, this is another view of that. This is the desert area here, and it's not as high, but it's very inaccessible. I've traveled through all of these areas, and it's just only camels there. Yeah. So here is the picture of China that we're presented with in the world, right, as this superpower, juggernaut, everywhere, all the time presence. And that's not untrue. There's that, but there's more than that. And while this is going on, because here's the picture of China that they like to present to the world, that they are this unified, seamless entity, right, that is moving forward in this intentional way. That's the picture they want to show, control, and that they have got this all figured out. Okay, here's where does Tibet fit in this picture of this unitary state? Okay, so this is the People's Republic of China territory. One quarter of that is Tibet. And one quarter, right? In fact, it's slightly bigger than one quarter if you work out the math. And it's not just any piece of land. It's strategically extremely important because of where it's located, how high it is. It contains the headwaters of almost all the major rivers for Asia, nearly all. So it's feeding 2 billion people water a day, right? So it's important for that. It's important for energy. It's important for many reasons. So we can talk about this later. But here's the thing that I think is less seen, right, internationally. And when I say this, here's my disclaimer. I mean, in the place that I usually give this presentation are to people who are whose everyday jobs is to know about China. Like their job is to do something policy related concerning China. So people in think tanks or in policy groups, governments, things like that. So it's not just internationally in general, but internationally, people whose job is to make a move on China really have a hard time to see that on this ginormous piece of land that the people that you meet are mostly Tibetan. Right? If you take out the military, take out the security apparatus, who feel very artificial. I mean, they're there, of course, and that's overwhelming. That's the nature of an occupation, a military occupation, which Tibet has had since 1959. But it's not the same as a colonization situation, like a settler society, where people have stayed and made roots, and they're going to stay. That doesn't happen. So people come. Like this has been happening for for many, many decades now, right? They come, they're stationed in Tibet, but then they leave as soon as they can. They rotate in and out. That's the kind of pattern that we see. And okay, I'm going to just give an illustration of this whole reality. This is Grand Teton, which is kind of one of the more famous mountains in this is in this is the Grand Teton in this one here. And so Tibetans don't yet generally climb mountains. People live on the plateau and then maybe do something on the mountain that's religious oriented or pilgrimage, that sort of thing. But they don't climb mountains the way that we have a mountain climbing kind of culture internationally. The reason why this example is really clear to me is that I was asked to go on a trip to climb this mountain. It was in the summertime, but even in the summertime, there was ice, and they gave us, crampons and everything. And I had never experienced mountain climbing as a sport before. But we were climbing. I don't know if there are mountain climbers here in this room, but it was organized by David Brashears, and it was Conrad Anker and Jimmy Chin, so people who are the elite mountain climbers in the world in the sport, who were doing an awareness building kind of climb for Tibet. So I was recruited to talk about Tibet all the way from, up to the top of the mountain and back. So literally I keep talking about these issues. Anyways, they asked me to come so that I could talk about Tibet while these guests were climbing the mountain. Okay, so this is how I had the experience, realized that what you do when you climb such a mountain, when there's ice on it, even in the summertime, is that you go up there, takes 2 days, then you spend 20 minutes taking pictures. So everybody's taking pictures to prove they were on the mountain, and then you get off that mountain because you cannot stay there, right? And it struck me that this is a 14,000-foot... this here is one of they say one of the 14ers, which means that it's, people make a point of climbing 14,000-foot mountains. Oops. So let me just say that the average elevation of that bioregion that I showed you before of Tibet, the plateau, the average elevation is basically at this height. For most of that area, everything is at that height, right? And a lot of people do actually live at that height. So they're conducting their lives at the height where everywhere else in the world, it's a sport. And it just struck me that, oh gosh, this is, for Tibet, this is where you have your school, this is where you live, but in the rest of the world, this is like a sport to get up to this altitude. North America, there are about, there's a handful of communities that are at 10,000 feet, above 10,000 or above, and they're all in Colorado. I think it's like 6 or 7 communities are permanent settlements. In Canada, the highest permanent residential kind of community is Lake Louise, and that's, what, I think 5,200 feet. So as you can see, much, 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 much lower than what we're talking about here, which is the average elevation on Tibet. Banff, I think, is, what, 4,600 feet? So, meaning that it is not normal in this world for people to live at this altitude. So this is one of the reasons why what I'm trying to describe to you is not just a matter of geography to it's interesting, but it's also something that the Chinese government has had to come to terms with, because they have found it really hard to colonize Tibet in the way that they have been able to colonize Inner Mongolia, that they have been able to colonize the Uyghur homeland, Xinjiang, and so forth. And I'm sure people have heard different things about these different places. Tibet works differently because of the geography. So that's the point that I'm trying to make here. So here, this is looking up from India, and kind of you can see the profile of what that feels like. Okay, so what I want to point to is what happened to the Chinese government's point of view on Tibet, what happened to their policy on Tibet during this long period when China went through this meteoric rise, right? And at the same time that we were doing this, we also had this incredible, just kind of a unicorn opportunity to build a school in our father's homeland. So this is what the school that the government built was. This is inside Tibet, inside one of these mountain communities. This is at about 11,000 feet is where this community is. This was the school that was in place. And again, during this early period of the rise of China, right, when the world was facilitating China's rise. Lindsay has a starring role in this part of the story, because this has been the starting point. The community here has been, some of you have maybe already been kind of part of the different efforts to raise money for the school, because really the heart of so much of the school building effort was in Lindsay. So anyways, Lindsay has a starring role here. Because of all of those efforts over many years, this is the school that we built. It's a primary school here, and this is a middle school. And it was just such a different kind of commitment, right, to education in a remote rural community. But it was also a stunning success, and it caught the eye, of the leadership inside Tibet, but all the way to Beijing. People really looked at this, because this was not just a strange kind of school that was funded by people from outside, and particularly exiled Tibetans, but it was also a school system that was built on Tibetan language education, so mother tongue education. Through all these years, we also did teach Chinese, but most of the subjects were taught in Tibetan. In fact, Chinese itself was taught in Tibetan, so the kids, you know, they're speaking Tibetan at home to their parents, they go to school, and they learn to speak Chinese, but through Tibetan language instruction, right? So in any case, this became a kind of a record-breaking school, and it became an example of how there could be mother tongue-based bilingual education for Tibetans in these remote areas. This is to say that while China is going through this rapid development and just a surge of investment and support for making China what it is today, we got to go to Tibet for a couple decades, you know, every year at least once, sometimes twice, sometimes three times for our nonprofit work. And we did things differently, as you can imagine. And if anybody's interested in this, we can have a longer conversation just about the work of our organization called Machik. We did parent-teacher meetings. You know, even though the parents were themselves illiterate, the parents had never been to school because most of these places had never had a school. So we were introducing new ideas and new ways of doing things. And it just led to results so quickly. I think there was such a hunger locally and regionally for these different opportunities. So this is one of these, our PTA meetings that we insisted on. But this is when we first started, this was the situation. And today, and I don't have very much lined up in terms of the photos from our Machik work, but the students who have graduated from our classes are now, they're doctors, they're lawyers, we have one surgeon, we have people who are, 13 of our teachers at the school today are from that first class that we graduated. And they're not just in that area, they're spread all over Tibet. Generally speaking, they don't stay in Chinese areas, they come back to some part of Tibet and serve in all these different ways. So it's been a thrill, it's been such a thrill, and the school continues today with a lot of constraints now because of the language instruction switch that has taken place. So if people are interested in that, we can talk about that too. So there's a lot of pressures ongoing. This is not what it looks like. I'm so sorry I didn't line up some of the after pictures. This is like the before pictures. What I'm trying to point out is that there was a trajectory between where in our experience, in our work in Tibet, where Tibet was and where it has come to. And it's something that has to do with where China was and what happened to China as well. So from the official narrative of Tibet in the Chinese government discourse, of course, in international discourse, this is what is presented as Tibet, which is just one third of the plateau, right? The rest of the plateau is kind of divided and affiliated with other provinces. And so you get the sense that, oh, this is the Tibet, what they call the Tibet Autonomous Region right here. So here is that thing, that Tibet Autonomous Region, which is like a third of that bioregion, that big area where people live with yaks at 14,000 feet, right? So where our little school is here. So outside of TAR, just like the Dalai Lama is from here, from the tippy northeastern part of this whole Tibetan region, just to give you an idea. But here's the interesting thing is that from the onset, from 1959 when the Chinese took over Tibet until now, the way they administer the region, the way they govern is that the entire bioregion has been designated as some kind of autonomous entity, administrative unit, and it's been designated as Tibetan. So down to the last little sliver here, if they're not part of the Tibetan Autonomous Region, they're part of the Tibetan Autonomous, a prefecture, a county, a township. So in some ways, this has been this is an example of that. If this is the bioregion, then these are all. This is a map of the counties placed on top of it. So you can see that even the Chinese have always administered this as different, as distinct as Tibetan, and also as. I mean, when they say autonomous, it doesn't mean that it's autonomous. Of course, it's the opposite. It lacks power, but it means that it's designated differently than, say, for the rest of China. What I'm getting at is a quarter of the PRC territory has been, continues to be run differently because it's Tibetan. Okay, so while we were working, doing our thing at the grassroots level, community building, and we did work, we started in our father's hometown, but we expanded. We had a couple of offices inside Tibet, one in the northeast area where the Dalai Lama's from. We did women's education scholarships there, and so you may have heard about that, but thousands of young women went through our program. So we just kept persisting over a long period of time. And then what happened was that in 2008, there was an uprising in Tibet that went from one side to the other. It just was amazing how fast it was and how kind of in tune it was. All these protests happening at once. So the official line in the Chinese government was that, oh, this is coordinated. This is a coordinated unrest and surely coordinated by the Dalai Lama. And in fact, it was not. I think it says something about how Tibetans from one end to the other had the same idea, right? And just felt the same way. But I think it's pretty clear from historical facts that Dharamsala, which is where the Dalai Lama is headquartered, that he also, that they just didn't know. Nobody expected that there's going to be this unrest in Tibet in 2008, as there was. And it changed everything. So this is a map of where the protests took place, and what they found, what the Chinese government realized, was that most of the protests took place outside of what they call the Tibetan Autonomous Region, right? And within a year, then a whole series of self-immolations began to happen, and today Tibet is considered the world capital of self-immolations. There just has been so many, and it's not just monks; it's men, women, and children, lay, and as well as clergy, people. One of the most recent self-immolations is like a Tibetan singer celebrity who self-immolated. So it's become a way of protesting. So not the kind of protest where you have a lot of people on the streets, but where an individual takes their own life that way. So the Chinese government has one set of projections to the world about their governing and controlling of Tibet. But then they have this other problem internally in terms of when you need to govern. And one of their number one strategies is to put a fire extinguisher on every street block, right? So that's their solution, is that it's just to take out the fire if somebody suddenly does it. So what they're not getting at is the feeling of resentment, the feeling of discontent that people feel, and because it is an authoritarian state, there's no space to say it. It's hard to express yourself under these conditions. So amazingly, as this is all happening, and it's all just, it is all catastrophic, it's all very dreadful. In 2008, because of that protest, the unrest that happened from one side of Tibet to the other, which looked coordinated but was not coordinated, and in fact, even Beijing knew that it was not coordinated. The second most powerful person in the country, his name was Wen Jiabao. He was the premier to the president, who was Hu Jintao at the time. For the first time in ever, we had never heard this before, but it was a different opinion. Because, you know, especially on an issue like Tibet, right, sensitive issue, just like Taiwan is, you know, when there's a human rights in general, when there's a sensitive issue, you want to show a united front, a solid kind of message. But this was a different message. So while the rest of the Chinese government all over the world was saying one thing about why this unrest was happening, and that this was the Dalai Lama who's a wolf in sheep's clothing, etc. Wen Jiabao, the premier, came out and on a global stage, he was in Laos at the time, gave a press conference where he took a planted question about Tibet and said something totally opposite. He acknowledged that the Dalai Lama was not the perpetrator. He did not create this. He did not coordinate all of this unrest across the country, and that the Chinese government would like his help to help suppress all of this unhappiness. So this was an amazing new development because we had never heard a top leader in the country have a different opinion, express it internationally, especially on Tibet. So that winter, there was an outreach by that same, it's called the State Council, which is it's an organ of government, so not part of the Chinese Communist Party. So they have a system where they have two streams always. There's the government side and a party side, right, in every level of government. The party person is more powerful usually, but still they have this other side, which is the government side. And the premier is technically the head of that side. And it was his sort of governmental organ called the State Council that did an outreach and basically wanted to understand why Tibetans are so unhappy, right? Because they had started to believe their own propaganda that Tibetans wanted to be governed and ruled by people themselves, right? Which was never the case. But this was a rude awakening is what I'm trying to say. 2008 was a very rude awakening. So in a nutshell, and this is about this mystery about how is it that the people whose job it is to think about China cannot see Tibet for what it is. It's also the Chinese government could not see Tibet for what it is. And so this is a seven-year process that took place. It was an academic dialogue. So through universities around the world, we had these dialogues about what is Tibet really. So just like we're talking today here, this is the conversation we had with the Chinese government, and lo and behold, in a few years, they had a work policy meeting. There's a certain kind of institution that they only had four times before. So this was the number five since the founding of the whole of contemporary China, where they had a fifth meeting, and they said that Tibet is the entire plateau. Right? Before they always used to say, oh, when we say Tibet, we mean this little bit, right? And at that meeting and until today, they say, well, when we say Tibet, we get it. Our problem is not that little bit. Our problem is the whole bit, which is a quarter of their territory. So this conversation that I'm trying to present today is also something that the Chinese government had to kind of wrap their minds around, because they did have a certain way of talking about it built into their constitution, and they had to see it empirically. They had to see it on the ground and how these places are very Tibetan still after 70 years of the Chinese rule. So the kinds of meetings that we've had have been so incredibly illuminating. So this was in Quebec that we met. This is in Shanghai, and up to 2024 we now meet in places where there are very effective regional autonomies. This was in South Tyrol, so on the sunny side of the Alps, but on the Italy side. But we also have done a lot of programming in the Basque Country, which is an amazingly successful regional autonomy in Spain. And we bring Tibetans from Tibet, but we also bring people from the Chinese policy world to try to understand alternatives to conflict, alternatives to just suppression and control, and just our solution is to put more fire extinguishers down the road. No, the solution is to listen and to hear and to find a way to somehow share power, because this is not working. And this is, I think, just to have these meetings and to bring people who work in policy issues to these places has been half the struggle. So we have a long way to go, but one thing I think that we've done is to re-territorialize Tibet. And the story that was imposed and that I think was very easy to fall into, especially during the time when there was such a rush to build China, right? I think it's important to see that the meteoric rise of China would not have been possible without the United States especially brokering China's integration into the global economy. It would not have been possible without Taiwan. Taiwan has always been the number one investor in China, has helped build China to what it is today. So I would say these two factors, the United States and Taiwan, really built China into what it has become. And I think there's been such a fixation on the GDP, right? The double-digit GDP, we have not seen anything like it. But it's really about scale, right? About how big China is. And in fact, when you look at per capita GDP, China does not look very good. It's somewhere near Libya, Kazakhstan, you know, Belarus. That's the level of per capita GDP that China has. Not that these numbers are definitive in explaining everything, but I think it is a situation where we were, when I say we, I mean just in general, the liberal West that believed that if China starts to get Starbucks, they're going to become just like us. You know, that was the belief, that it will liberalize. You liberalize the economy, somehow magically the system will liberalize. But I think we've seen the opposite. It has not behaved how we expected. It is more authoritarian than it was back in the 1980s, quite frankly. And it's more concentrated in power. It's Xi Jinping had, they used to have this term limit system. You could only be president for 2 terms. And in 2018, he just set that aside. He said, nope, not interested. I'm just going to be president forever and ever. Nobody knows when he's going to step down, maybe never. And it's quite funny that, of course, the current president right now of the United States tweeted out, as he does, on every subject, and just kind of envious of him. He said, oh, wow, he can do this, you know. I think giving people bad ideas all over the world in setting aside constitutional norms. So this is the set of things, and I know I'll have to pause pretty soon, but the set of things that I think is really clear now is China has a problem of scale, right? And it doesn't like to project that internationally, but they really have no idea how a lot of their country works, right? The parts that work extremely well are along the coast. The places where they intentionally built special economic zones. But in general, what we've seen over time is more and more regionalization of China, right? Which means that there is more and more decentralization of how the state operates, how governance works. So it's a fragmentation of governance over time. So an example of this is what they call the Belt and Road Initiative, right? Which is the thing that brings companies to Africa, to Latin America, all over the world, right? There's somehow a presence, you know, huge presence, right? They're the ones building the stadiums, they're building the airports, they're building, because they have the cash. They have the cash because that's the way we invested in them. Anyways, the point is that this so-called BRI, and people are very, I understand, like the way that it works is really, in these kinds of developing countries, is entirely, it's entirely wrong. So, they actually, even down to the fruit sellers, they bring their own fruit sellers. So it's not in any kind of integrated way. They build big giant things because they have the cash, but they set themselves up very in an insulated way. So there's no connection to the local communities. So it's created so much tension, as you can imagine, and longer term problems. But here's the thing, is that I think people see that when you're in an African country or you're in Nicaragua and these ginormous things are happening, right? Suddenly you have a soccer stadium and the Chinese built it for you. So the perception is, oh, China did that. In terms of the way that it works inside China is that it's a competition between provinces. It's Hunan versus Guangzhou versus, you know, Shanxi. And they don't answer to Beijing, right? They have regulators. The regulators are in those provinces. So they answer to the BRI regulators in their own provinces, right? So there's a fragmentation that has happened to China as a state, and that's reflected in how they behave internationally. But we perceive this is just China doing this thing. But behind it is their own inability to rein things in. And I think that's also why we've seen Xi Jinping being so extreme. The current leader of China has been extreme in saying, okay, now we're going to consolidate power, because it hasn't been consolidated. It's been all over the place. Shanghai won't even pay tax to Beijing, right? I'm not saying everywhere, but this is the kind of of momentum that has been developing over time, which is that there is an incredible regionalization and decentralization of how things actually work in China. And so what are some of the implications of that? For Tibet, so many counterintuitive facts, but one is that there was this huge expectation that the Chinese would just flood Tibet in terms of population transfer, and Tibet would disappear because of that. And the opposite has happened. We now see that migrant laborers are leaving the region. This is at a time when, for China itself, it's in a process of a demographic collapse. I'm sure you've seen this in the news, but it started in 2022. Starting in 2022, the Chinese population is decreasing at a rate that we have never seen before in human history. So the Shanghai Academy of Social Sciences did a major study with an Australian university, Victoria University, where they predicted that by the end of the century, the Chinese population is going to be about half of what it is today. That's how fast they're decreasing in their population. Part of it for the reasons we know, but part of it for the very strange one-child policy that they had for more than a generation. For several generations, they had a strict one-child policy, and once they got ultrasounds into villages, it was all male, right? So they have a very peculiar situation that now no policy can undo. So this is like a major project for the Chinese government, is try to figure out how do we stop this, how do we reverse this, or at least moderate this, but they feel like this is now undoable because of how extreme the discipline was in implementing the one-child policy. Meanwhile, in Tibet, there's a baby boom. You know, one of the things that we know since working in these deep inside these mountain communities is that the so-called ethnic minorities were allowed to have two children, right? So two registered children. So what Tibetans would do in these mountains was that they would carry on as they as they wished. They had four, five, six children, but only two were registered, right? So, but the system didn't produce any schools to register for anyway, so it didn't matter. But once we built the school, then, you know, I was actually the one who went into these hamlets, into these tiny little areas, and I realized, wow, there's five kids here, and technically, not supposed to be the case. So Tibet has a very different demographic profile, which isn't to say that that determines any outcome, but it's just unexpected. It's just not the story that people imagine. So people imagine that Tibetans are overrun by Chinese, and they are on this kind of linear kind of trajectory towards disappearance, because there's, after all, a billion plus Chinese in the world, in China. But inside Tibet, on this plateau, which is very difficult to live in, and nobody really wants to live there. You may be assigned to work there, but nobody really wants to, you know, make a family there, you know, and stay there, unless you have the adaptations to high altitude, as Tibetans do. This is a whole other presentation on DNA. Tibetans have a different DNA. So demographically, we have the situation, unemployment. This is just pointing to all the underlying conditions that make Tibet very different from what people imagine. So right now, we have the highest number of Tibetans who are graduating from college. And I know this sounds insane. The official number is 35 to 40% are unemployed. But from internal documents that we have seen, it's probably up to 80%. So that means that vast number of Tibetans who are graduating from college, they're very capable, right? They could be doing a lot of different things, and everybody's not working. So this is just a volatile situation. The thing that we've been doing ever since is doing more of this academic track two dialogue, we call it, in places like the Basque Country, which straddles Spain and France, and they are just the loveliest hosts. And in the event that we're going to do future events and people are interested, please let me know, because it's just really heartening just to see their political experiment, how they managed to carve out an existence that's truly outstanding. They have the highest per capita income in Spain. They're an autonomous region that doesn't take a penny from Madrid. And at the end of the year, they actually donate money back so that the revenue that they generate, because they are so disciplined and so visionary in how they want to see a Basque future, they generate a lot. And they do extremely well. So this is just an example of how we do work to basically create this conversation and generate more awareness about what is possible for Tibet, how there can be multi-level governance, there can be more power for people who are in dispossessed situations such as Tibet. And we do this in South Tyrol and Kurdistan, elsewhere. Yep. So I'm going to be closing on this, which is just to say that the reason why I feel like this speaks to the world right now is that China has such a powerful place in our global imagination right now because they are relevant to everything. And I think that the inside of China looks very different. And Tibet is a very big part of the inside of China. And it is a volatile area that the Chinese government realizes and they do not want to be part of the global conversation. But if it were part of the conversation, I think what we can see is that the world has already come up with many solutions for how we can have territories that are very different, that had maybe tragic histories, as Tibet did certainly. And in any case, how you can create a way of governing and a way of being in coexistence that doesn't require conflict. And we're pointing to these examples and we're trying to build communities and networks of people who are more and more interested and engaged in the possibilities for how places that I think people have written off. You know, people in the world feel like these are hopeless causes, these are doomed, because how can you be, you know, competing with people who are, you know, going to be the future superpowers of the planet? It's not quite like that. And in fact, the more that I have been able to spend time building things and something inside Tibet, not just going there, but actually building something with local communities, you see that there's so much potential. And after all, for a place that is so strategically important like Tibet, why wouldn't you want the Tibetans themselves to be the stewards and to be the people who are in charge? Thank you.